Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books and Library Science podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Amagna. As we think about public libraries, they are equipped with spaces, resources, and services designed to support both parents and children. When it comes to academic libraries, the spaces, resources, and services are designed primarily to support traditional undergraduate students and academic research. While academic libraries are re-envisioning spaces to support students, these spaces are not necessarily designed for student parents. Today, I'm joined by the authors of Supporting Student Parents in Academic Libraries, Designing Spaces, Policies, and Services, published in 2024 by the Association of College and Research Libraries. Kelsey Keyes is an emerita professor at Boise State University and currently the managing editor of Critical AI from Duke University Press, as well as the copy editor for College and Research Libraries and Rare Books and Manuscripts, both ACRL publications. And Ellie Dvorak, who is an associate professor and research data librarian at Boise State University. Welcome to the podcast, Kelsey and Ellie.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I'm excited to get talking.
Excellent. So before we discuss your book, Supporting Student Parents in Academic Libraries, Designing Spaces, Policies, and Services, I was hoping you can tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and your path into academic librarianship.
Sure. So let's see. I have undergraduate degrees in English literature and French. And then after undergrad, went to graduate school. I was in a PhD program for English literature. And then got 4 years into that, was facing down writing a dissertation and considering whether I was going to get a job at the end of that, and decided it might be time to switch paths. I'll be perfectly honest, I hadn't known previously really that library school was an option, hadn't ever thought about how to get into the profession, but I had a good friend who had gone to library school, and so I was able to talk to him about it. And I was at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for the English PhD program, and UIUC happens to have an amazing library science program as well. So that was actually a relatively easy switch for me. So I left the program with my master's in English literature and then did the library and information science program at University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And then after that, I got a job in Idaho and I at the College of Idaho. So I moved out for that. And after a couple of years there, I got the job at Boise State University, and then I was an assistant professor and instruction and research librarian, and then got tenure, so associate professor in 2018, and then left Boise State University in 2023.
To move to the Netherlands.
Yes.
which is exciting. So I I also have a degree in English, and I wasn't sure what to do with my degree in English. I was considering graduate school, but it didn't quite feel like a perfect fit to me. So I had a very wonderful professor of medieval literature who set up some information interviews with several librarians, because that seemed like something I might like doing. I think I even went to the Career Center and I took the personality test, and that was on the list. So when I met with the reference librarian at University of Oregon, where I got my degree, he brought his inbox, and this was in 1994, so it was a physical inbox, you know, and showed me the things he was working on, and it really appealed to me to be able to stay in the academic setting, interact with students, and have such a diversity of activities. I'm easily bored. So I went to the University of Michigan and I received my master's in information and library studies in 1996. I worked at Ohio University for several years. Then I moved to San Diego State University and then Boise State in 2008. The bulk of my career has been as a research and instruction or reference librarian and, you know, and liaison. I'm old school. I remember when we used to have approval shelves for the books and you could go in and kind of like book shop for books and I had a budget. But as part of being the reference services coordinator at Boise State, I was in charge of our LibQual survey, which is the Associated Research Libraries survey of, it's like quality and opinions about the library. And I got really interested in the data analysis piece. It turns out that I really enjoy that. I have not had a college math class, so I did a lot of my own professional development. And in 2018, I was offered the opportunity to write my own job description and become the research data librarian. And so that role, I'm doing more working with faculty members to manage data. And I'm really enjoying it. But, you know, my roots are in public service. And I will always, you know, I will always care about our students deeply.
And we can see that in the book. So let me ask you, what sparked your interest in looking at the needs of student parents in academic libraries?
And I talk about this in the book as well, but it was about 2014 and I had recently had my first child. I think that's part of the reason I started to notice this more, but the reference desk that it used to be straight in front of the door when you came into the library. And so you could just see everybody coming and going. And I began to notice people coming in with their kids. And it's kind of an echoey entrance that we had. And people would be shushing their kids and just getting in and out as quickly as possible and kind of trying to just clearly not get in trouble for bringing their kids into the library. It just was really clear to me. And I thought, I wonder how many people on campus have kids and are trying to bring them in. And I didn't even know if we had a policy about whether or not children were allowed in the library. And I asked a coworker who was in access services, and she said that we didn't have an official policy. We still don't, actually. And that it generally only came up if there were noise complaints, that somebody might complain about noise. And that was at the time. Upper floors of our library were quieter, but the first floor was never really a quiet place. That was a collaborative space anyway. And so I didn't see these children necessarily being any noisier than some of the activities that were taking place on the first floor. So, but then in particular, one incident stood out in my mind, which was, I saw a woman come in. She had a toddler with her, and then she had a baby she was carrying in one of those bucket car seats. And she sat down at a computer that was just outside of my office and kind of was trying to tuck the toddler in next to her, trying to tuck the car seat in so that nobody would trip on it. And she had the toddler then on her lap, and she was clearly just trying to type up a paper and get it printed. Something we see students coming into the library do all the time, like totally typical library activity, and, you know, trying to kind of ward off the toddler from typing on it. And I thought, I wonder if I could give her a hand. I had some toys in my office, and I just thought, I'll just go out there and see if I can give her a hand, because she was clearly had a lot going on. And she saw me walking towards her, and her face just fell. and looked so worried. And she said, I'm so sorry about them. I'm going to get out of here soon. I just need to get this paper printed. I'll get out of here really soon. I'm so sorry. And it just kind of broke my heart. I was like, no, I am not coming to yell at you. I was coming to see if I could give you a hand. Like, I have kids. I understand. Like, you're just trying to do what you need to do. But the fact that she so clearly felt unwelcome, she was unwelcome. We didn't have a space for her toddler. We didn't have a place where she could even kind of tuck her baby's car seat so that it was out of the way. Like, the space was not designed for her. And she was a student there, just like any other student, trying to use our library, just like any other student. And she thought I was coming to yell at her. And it was very sad, because I'm sure that there was a reason she felt that way. I'm sure she felt unwelcome. Perhaps people had said something to her in the past. So those were a couple of things that really sparked my initial interest. And I started just approaching people when they came in with their kids. And I'd always get that reaction. They'd kind of look panicked. I'm like, no. I just was wondering if you'd talk to me. I was just kind of thinking long-term about maybe I could do some interviews or set up some focus groups or something like that, because I began to see that this was a population that was there, and those were kind of the really early seeds of my interest in the topic.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I really related to that experience that you described in your book. As a librarian at a community college, a large portion of our students are non-traditional students, and we often have student parents coming into our library and learning commons with the same kind of reaction when a staff member approaches them, of that panic of, I'll be done quick, just let me go. And so really, this work is a great, way for libraries to think about how they can support those students. Now, before we jump into the actual content of your book, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the structure. So you open each chapter with learning objectives and then conclude each chapter with discussion questions. So are you designing this book as a textbook? Are you designing this book for structured professional development in libraries as a toolkit? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the structure.
Michael, do you mind if I jump in with the answer to the last question?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I just wanted to say, Kelsey and I are collaborated in the past on articles. And so she brought me in as to help with the data analysis. And I was just really taken aback. I always intellectually understood it would be more difficult to be a student as a parent, but I didn't. I was just really, really surprised by the number of barriers and the lack of support that students received, especially from instructors. When you think about this, childcare is probably the most important thing we can offer student parents, but 77% of Kelsey's 2020 survey said the most valuable support they could have received was more flexible classroom policies. And some of the comments were frankly shocking. Here's one: I've had professors who wouldn't budge even a few hours on an assignment, who wouldn't allow me to make up work, who wouldn't provide alternative work to make up points lost from missing a class due to family issues. And so, that really drew me in. I don't have children, but I have a strong sense of justice, and it just seemed unfair. Our culture places this huge premium on self-efficacy, and I think that's important, but it doesn't really, it doesn't take account for the realities of many of our students today, not just parenting students, students with mental health problems, students who are experiencing, financial and food and housing insecurity. And so, I just want to highlight that our institutions are charging these students money and then work identifying them as the problem. And that's not okay. So I just wanted to say that. And then I'll let Kelsey address the textbook comment, but I'm glad you noticed.
Well, and actually, if you don't mind, I promise we will circle back around to the structure of the book. You said it in the introduction as well, and I thought, oh, that's going to be the perfect opening for me, which is traditional students, the idea of traditional and non-traditional students. So one of the things I found fairly early on in research was that the U.S. Department of Education, they published a report in 2015, and they had been gathering data since 1996 on this and found that on traditional students and non-traditional students. So I kind of want to challenge that idea of who is the traditional student. So some of their categories were things like students being financially independent from their parents, having a child or other dependent, being a single caregiver, attending school part-time, and delaying school or being employed while also going to school. And they found that 74% of undergrads fall into one of these categories, and about a third have two or three of those categories. So if we're talking about who's traditional and who's non-traditional, it's actually by far the majority fall under these categories of what we call non-traditional, untraditional. So why are all our services focused on this quote unquote traditional student when that is not at all the actual student body? And then to think about who is the university for? And there's a long history, of course, of universities and a complex history there, but it's for young, single men without other responsibilities, not going to school, not having children. They're there to be purely minds, their brains going to school. And that's just not the reality of who our student bodies are at four-year institutions, at community colleges, anywhere. And so we've got to think about reshaping our universities to actually serve the students who are there. And like Ellie pointed, Ellie said, like they're paying. They are our students. We need to be serving them.
And not to take us farther off track, but you know, schools are starting to, universities and colleges are starting to realize that they need to serve these other students. We other them, but they're not, since the student parents aren't counted, and maybe we'll address this further later. The services that are being developed aren't taking the student parents into account. Thanks. Textbook.
Yeah, Ellie, do you want to talk about the structure of the book? Because I feel like you were really the bigger driving force behind that.
Well, yeah, thank you. You know, when we realized we had a book, we just think this topic is so very important that we hope that it will be used as a textbook in library schools, and or at least that, you know, chapters can be used because, well, I don't know what else to say, but we do envision that it could be used as a textbook or a book for, you know, librarians to have a reading circle and have some topics to talk about. Because the book delves into a lot of related material, such as, you know, other countries, higher education generally, basic needs and security among college students that aren't necessarily parents. I wanted to, at the end of each chapter, we decided to put this putting it into practice section to bring it back around to libraries because, you know, we needed to delve into all this material, but really wanted to focus on the solutions that librarians and library administrators and staff can provide.
I take that a step further and say that I think everybody in higher education, I think admin across higher education should be reading it, not just libraries. And we might get into this later as well. I think libraries can lead the way on some of these things, but I really, truly think that this needs to reach even further on campuses. And I would love it if the book were read by deans in other colleges and the presidents and, you know, all the higher ups in universities. Because there's need across the university, not just in the library, even though, of course, we're librarians and that's our focus.
Yeah. I mean, we're librarians, that's our focus. And in some ways, I kind of wish we didn't have to have the word academic libraries because it's really in higher education. But we do circle back on every chapter to academic libraries.
Well, I will say the structure does work as a standalone book, will work as a textbook within library science programs, will work as a nice tool to facilitate book discussions and professional development. And those questions at the end were really good thought questions to get people thinking about this issue. So there's a lot of threads we can pull on that we've really touched on right here. Let's go back to data, right? Because you discussed the importance of data as it relates to student parents in higher education and maybe the limited data that is available. I have to be honest with you, we have an institutional effectiveness office at my institution that provides us with a wealth of data. And as I was reading that section, I was like, let me put the book down for a sec and go see what's available through our institutional effectiveness office. And You're not surprised. I was a bit surprised. there was no data there on what percentage of our student population were student parents. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about where we can find some of this data. What are some of the challenges in obtaining this data? And then, you know, what does the data that we have access to tell us about these students?
That was one of the biggest challenges early in my research, and that it continued throughout our writing of the book on all of it. I was convinced pretty quickly that there was a significant student population, even if it was anecdotal and just from who I was seeing come in and use the library. And I thought, here's a fun pilot project. Let's take one of our study rooms, turn it into a family study room. Again, we're talking, this was back in 2014, and the library didn't open our family study room until 2021. So that tells you what an uphill path this was. I thought it was a pretty easy project to undertake. We could put a few things in there, call it a family study room, see if it got use for a year, and then make a decision based on that. And the pushback I immediately got was, well, are there that many parenting students? Who's going to use it? I don't think there's that many of them. Can you tell me how many there are? So I went looking, and no, I could not tell the dean, how many parenting students there were, because we don't count them. And Ellie, feel free to jump in on this too, of all the people all the different categories we do keep track of. We collect data on our students on so many different topics. And one of them is that we don't even look at caregiving status or anything like that. And that's a big gap in the data. And again and again, I came up against this is, show me the data, convince me that the population is out there by showing me the numbers, and then we'll talk about it. We'll consider it. And so finally, I ended up in applying for a sabbatical and taking a sabbatical, which turned out to be during the pandemic. So that changed the some of the things I could do on my sabbatical. But I could at least still do a survey, because I thought I had to get the numbers, and the numbers weren't there. So I had to get the numbers myself. I had to go out and do some of this survey myself. So my initial survey was in October 2020. And of course, that was a weird time to be surveying people, because a lot of things were changing and a lot of things were up in the air. And not to go too far down this tangent, but we did definitely find that the number of parenting students enrolled dropped. And even if the firm numbers aren't there, I think Ellie and I both strongly suspect that the pandemic had a big impact on that, because it had a huge impact on everything, of course. But if you were struggling with different things, school is often the thing that you can drop. And so the number of parenting students has dropped, but I think that doesn't mean that they aren't important. I think that means that things got so hard for them that they couldn't go to school. So that's kind of its own issue. And so I collected that early data and then came back. And that's kind of when Ellie jumped in with me too, because she's so great with all the data analysis and all of that. And we did an additional survey in 2022 to give us a more accurate number, we hope, of the number of parenting students at Boise State University. And I will also say on this point that it's Oregon, right, Ellie? That in Oregon, they started to put forth some legislation to gather information about parenting status. They wanted at state universities to start having that be one of the questions that was asked. And it's called something like Make Our Voices Count or Our Voices Count, something like that. Like, we need to count these parenting students, or we are literally overlooking them. So when they feel unseen, when they feel overlooked, they are. We are not seeing them because we're not counting them. And if we don't have that data, it's really easy for people to say, no, I don't think there's that many. No, we don't need to provide special services for them. There's lots of people who want a special room in the library. Why should we give one to parents?
So, I'd like to address a couple of points. First of all, it was unfortunate that the pandemic happened when it did. And at the same time, I feel like we got a wealth of information from Kelsey's preliminary survey because it was during the pandemic. And like one quote is, you know, COVID brought about a ton of additional anxiety, knowing that childcare could close at a moment's notice, and the fear of needing to figure out how to be a full-time student and mom for the remainder of the semester. And we have many quotes like that from both the 2020 and the 2022 surveys. So it's not only are the numbers going down nationally, which we've seen from the National Post-Secondary Student Aid Survey or NPSAS, but you know, these students are, we have that qualitative, you know, data as well, which is just heartbreaking. There's a couple things. First of all, the biggest source of student parent data available is the NPSAS, which the book covers in a chapter one, I believe, how to get to that data. Unfortunately, you know, the Department of Education is a bit behind. So the data we were working with for the book, for the bulk of the book, was 2018. But then when we got the manuscript back, the 2020-2021 data had just come out. So I frantically updated throughout wherever possible. You know, but still, that's still, you know, there's a 2024 NPSAS coming. It probably won't get, you know, released until 2027, you know, so that's difficult. Another source of student parent data that's local to your institution is financial aid, FERPA. There is an option, you know, for students to indicate if they're a parent, only if they are the custodial parent, however. And you know, there are impacts of being a non-custodial parent on your, you know, on your ability to complete an education also. But there's that. However, you know, people that work in financial aid offices and, you know, business affairs generally are very concerned with, you know, privacy, as they should be. Much of this data is protected. However, there are legitimate reasons to share. And, you know, being able to get access to FERPA data about student parents, it would be a very powerful way to do outreach, to identify the numbers of students, and get services to them. That's not, you know, breaking any federal regulations. It's just a matter of developing these relationships and educating people in these offices. I also want to point out that not, you know, students feel ignored, but there are very real impacts of not having this data. For instance, you know, many colleges and universities have risk analysis systems that flag students who need extra support. That factor, you know, parenting isn't included as a factor. So those students, they may get flagged for other reasons, but maybe it's too late at that point. Student services. I looked up our registrar's office is open 8 to 5, Monday through Friday in person. Our academic advising services are open. You know, there are some online options, but 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. Strategies for retention. You know, we have a strategic something retention program at Boise State. It's looking at Hispanic students, at first generation students, at students who are Pell Grant eligible. That's wonderful. And I'm glad we're doing that. And those groups overlap with student parents a lot. But the solutions they're looking at aren't necessarily going to help student parents specifically. For instance, they're looking at trying to, you know, provide more dorms. Well, there's no family housing. There's no move toward family housing here. And that's a big ask, I realize, but it's also an equity issue. You know, a Title IX says that we need to treat people the same regardless of gender or parenting status. And then we say, this is a huge service that you don't have access to. And then finally, you know, I'd like to point out that, you know, some of those, you know, recently or at least emerging educational practices that are generally supportive of student learning and success, like increased, you know, field work, internships, these kinds of things, are not good for parenting students because, first of all, it's hard to predict the hours up front. You know, when you set your schedule, you can set your work schedule around that. You can set up childcare. But if you're doing stuff evenings and weekends or randomly, even group work, you know, group projects, childcare is much more expensive during the weekend and evening hours, and it's not always available. So these things are, you just have to start to think differently. Like, just because something's good for some students doesn't mean it's going to work for all of them. And we need to come up with alternatives.
And I'm really glad too that Ellie mentioned group work, just because that came up several times, both in interviews I did one-on-one with students and in some of our survey responses. More than once, I had students say that I think there's even more group work now than when I was an undergrad 20 plus years ago. And they said that they would have to ask if their group members would meet them at a McDonald's or a Burger King or some place where their children could play, and how bad they always felt about that, because they would often be in a group with other 18-year-old kids who didn't necessarily want to go off campus or go to a McDonald's or someplace like that. And the fact that this was mentioned to me by multiple students just really stood out, that they had tried to find a place where they could take their kid, have their kid be occupied, and still get the work done with their group that they needed to do. And that's exactly what the library should be providing, is that kind of space. And that's what, you know, we were hoping, one of the things we're hoping to provide with the family study room. But yeah, just not meeting these students where they're at and kind of dealing with the reality of their lives. And Ellie mentioned some of the like labs and extra things like that. We also had a respondent who I believe was a geology major who talked about the struggle of they needed to have a 2-week field experience. And it sounded great if you were, you know, 18 and unencumbered, you get to go be in tents and do field work for 2 weeks. It kind of sounded fun to me, but wholly different if you have kids and no accommodation for that whatsoever.
And I have to say, it also seems likely that that's not great for students with disabilities or, you know, other situations either, students with jobs. I am happy to announce that I worked with a faculty member to write a data management plan for a grant to do alternative fieldwork for geosciences, Kelsey. So hopefully he gets that NSF grant. Yeah. I had something to say, but I'm just going to say it later because I can't remember.
Well, and Ellie mentioned retention as well. And I did eventually learn that that was one of the words that I could use to get attention for this topic. Yes. Was retention, because parenting status is deeply tied to retention. I've got a couple of numbers here. 53% of parents, compared to 31% of non-parents, left college after 6 years without a degree. And those attrition rates are even worse when you look at low-income parenting students.
And yet their grades are better.
Yes, their grades are better. As a whole, like across the board, student parents have higher GPAs, but also higher attrition rates. So retention is really connected in all of this as well.
And then looping back to not counting people, you know, students notice when they're not counted, when our campuses aren't designed for, you know, children to be on them at all, when there's no parents with, you know, older adults or students with children in the marketing materials. And that's one reason, I believe, and I think Kelsey addresses this in the chapter on for-profit schools, you know, they really do a good job with their marketing. They don't do such a good job actually providing services for students with children. But, and, you know, to quote directly from the book on page 73, belonging has a powerful effect on cognition and behavior is a predictor of persistence to graduate among undergraduate students. And one quote from one of our students that we surveyed, I wish there were more family-friendly activities on campus for students, especially in the freshman year. I have struggled to be part of BSU due to having to prioritize family over any campus events. And, you know, we know that building a learning community is so important for college success. So creating these opportunities is really a critical need. And the library can help to do that because we're a shared space. We aren't affiliated with any single department or college.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up representation and belonging. That is such a huge issue. Now, I want to bring our conversation to policy issues. So you mentioned that you're at the reference desk. You see this student parent having some issues, you go over there and it sparked that, like, maybe I should go look at what the policy is, and you didn't find one. And I'm sure many academic libraries probably don't have a specific policy related to student parents or even children in the library. I could speak to my own institution. We did not until this became an issue for us. And then we started working on that policy. So I was just wondering, what did your research on policies tell you about how academic libraries are approaching this? So what did you find?
Yeah, thank you. That was kind of one of my entrees into this topic, was once I was learning that we weren't counting parenting students and I couldn't kind of get to that directly, I was trying to think of other ways to angle into this research. And I did start to look at policies. And published an article on this in 2017. I looked at the policies at the 80 institutions with the highest enrollment across the US, taking away four-year institutions, and I also took away for-profit institutions as well. And then I went looking for library policies. I did some Googling and I learned so much from that research. So what I found was most of the time I couldn't find a policy. Sometimes it took a little bit of creative work. I would chat with a librarian if a reference chat was available. I'd look at their FAQs. I'd only kind of go so far with that because I'm like, if I'm a reference librarian, a trained reference librarian, and I can't find the policy, then I'm going to assume that an average student can't find the policy either. And found so. The majority did not have policies. And then I started to kind of drill down on those that did have policies and hadn't really thought about this up front, but realized that having a policy wasn't necessarily in and of itself a good, because it might be a very unwelcoming policy. So I found, oh gosh, I'd have to look at the book to get my exact numbers of that, you know, on this, but very few libraries had policies, even fewer had welcoming policies. And I counted welcoming policies, by the way, as literally just including the word welcome. They could say your children are welcome to accompany you and then have a list of rules after that. But I'm like, oh, it said welcome. So that one counts. But the other cool thing that came out of that is that I did find a handful of libraries that had family study rooms. And that was initially one of my plans with sabbatical, as we're going to do some visits to some of these other libraries and look at their family study rooms, which was not able to happen in the end. But that kind of planted that idea of like, see, other people do have this family study room. And I stumbled across some other really cool things, like I believe it's Oregon State University had in-library drop-in daycare, which blew my mind. And that's included in the book. And I never in a million years would have proposed that as something that maybe we could do to support student parents, because it just felt so wild to me. So it was really cool to see that. And I believe that students could get 3 hours a day of free drop-in childcare. And it was all accredited, you know, caregivers and everything like that. It was not anything odd there. And right there in the library, and I spoke with the woman who ran it for several years, and the parent would be given a buzzer, kind of like one of those buzzers you get when you're at a restaurant and you were hopefully supposed to stay in the library, but they were like, you know, parents got to use those 3 hours for whatever they needed to do. And that just was amazing to me, to provide that level of support. And then I believe it's University of Colorado in Boulder had something like that as well, had childcare available, and just thought that was really great. So it's just that early research that I did when I was trying to find my way into the topic actually really opened my eyes to some of the possibilities out there and seeing what other libraries were doing.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, half didn't have policies or maybe more. It's page 85. Of course, not all of those were particularly welcoming, you know. We see this with the survey we did of deans, library deans also, you know, and I'm, you know, most deans recognize that children could be in the library, you know, that it was a space children, you know, all students should be able to be there. But there's all this sort of almost punitive language around it, like, so long as you're supervising the child, as if like, I mean, I know that occasionally it happens that somebody doesn't supervise a child, but, you know, there's no reason to assume that. And then there's, you know, the issue of noise. Well, a lot of students make noise. Can't the noise policy address that? Does it really have to just be about kids? And another thing is, you know, if you don't make these policies easy to find, students are going to assume that the student that they're not allowed to have kids in the library, we found. And there's also this assumption culturally and among student parents that libraries are quiet spaces. And, you know, I believe I made this point about bringing students into the classroom. If you look that, if you Google that, you will find some speech that kind of qualifies as hate speech from non-parenting students about how angry it made them. And it's really like there's a lot of things that are disruptive in a classroom. Is there a need to single out, you know, student parents this way? And I'm sure that there have been student parents who've had been shushed by other library patrons. I'm sure of it. Because I've been shushed by library patrons and I'm not a child. Yeah, it's just, you know, going back to that, the university being set up for this, there's this, not to get too philosophical, but the Cartesian ideal, you know, dualism between body, mind, you know, so you really do, you're supposed to leave your life at home when you come to school and just bring your brain, and anything embodied is a threat that I think culturally we overreact to. Is it really that disruptive, really? Or is it just that you think it's inappropriate because we expect school to be a certain thing and libraries to be a certain thing?
So let me ask you, what should we consider to include in a policy that addresses student parents and children in the library so that it is welcoming and not hostile to those student parents?
I think the word welcome is a start. Having a policy and having the word welcome in there, I fully understand that the children should, especially young children, should be supervised. I think that's a fair standard to put in there. And I think other than that, not treating them wildly differently. Like Ellie said, sometimes there would say, it would say like your children are allowed in the library. And then, like I said, it'd have a laundry list of things to watch out for. And all of them are things that an undergrad could do as well. They could be noisy. They could spill food. They could look at something inappropriate on a computer. They could take a book and tear a page out of it. I honestly don't think that any of it is something that probably hasn't happened on the regular with undergrad students that children would do. And again, yes, supervise them. Having a parental presence is there. I can see the importance of that. And occasionally a policy would just point out, hey, our computers aren't filtered, kind of like a heads up type of thing. I think that's fair too, if you want to put that in there. But honestly, I think adding on anything else almost goes too far to single out children as a particular problem in a way that they don't need to be singled out.
If I had a dollar for every time I read or heard from somebody who I told about my book that the lactation room was the bathroom floor or was a coat closet or that they had to walk, you know, to way across campus to get to it, I would be, wouldn't have to come to my job anymore. You know, it's just sad. And that's like a biological function that, you know, the law says you have to, that you have to provide this, you know, and it's not supposed to be a bathroom. There are institutions who simply, this is something Kelsey discovered, pay the fine every year rather than have a lactation room. And these are major institutions, not, yeah.
That was shocking. Yeah, some of these things I considered very low hanging fruit. And that includes federally mandated lactation spaces, for one, but also like changing tables in bathrooms. I think I probably considered that low hanging fruit because we had them in the library. So I didn't think too much of it. And a lot of places you go these days have those changing tables there. But then as I did further research, we talked with further people, we had different people contribute to the book as well. And one of them is about how they kind of made their own changing table, finding out that that is not as easy or widely available as I would have assumed. So even those kinds of things are so, so basic, and often libraries don't even have those. Not that the library has to have a lactation room, but they libraries can be a good space for that, I'd argue, because they are so central, often on university campuses, and they are just kind of this hub where students tend to go anyway. And we can hopefully provide that space.
So now that we're talking about libraries as space, because I think that's how a lot of people think of libraries is the physical space. Can you talk a little bit about how you transformed some space at Boise State, specifically the study room that you've mentioned quite a bit?
Yeah, and that I wanted for so long was my heart's desire. I really, really wanted a family study room for such a long time. What we ended up doing was taking one of our larger study rooms. We were pretty strategic about which one we chose. It's on the first floor. We figured we don't need to add in stairs or elevators, for people with strollers or multiple kids, anything like that. And we also had it toward the back of the library, which is to say further away from the front entrance, thinking that you don't need kids darting out a front door if you're not paying attention. It's an enclosed room. What we ended up with is an enclosed room. There's one point in the book where I talk about kind of different levels of things you could do. I think it'd be great to, if you don't have a dedicated study room, that you can give to student parents, if you put out a kids' table with some blocks on it and it was near the other regular study tables, that's just this visual cue, like throw down a kids' rug, done. That's this visual cue, like, oh, there might be kids here. So if you want a quieter space, you go somewhere else. If you are a student parent, you see that space and you're like, cool, that's where we're going. I'm taking my kid to that space. Nobody's going to yell at me if I'm over there.
Well,
Luckily, we
see,
were.
there was one school where they kind of used bookshelves to cordon off a space and then put desks, high desks around it so that people could work with other, classmates, but still see their kids in that space, which I thought was genius.
Very smart. Kind of like gate the kids in a little bit. But then they also had kids' books on that side. And then, yeah, the parents were sitting up at tables and you could still keep an eye on your kids. But we were lucky. We had an enclosed room. And then I potentially go into too much detail of how we converted it, but in the book, but we wanted it to look fun and welcoming. We also had to stick to university standards in terms of what colors we could paint the walls and things like that. But we wanted to have it a little bit bright and fun. We had the carpets cleaned, fresh paint put in, dragged out all the furniture that was in there. We had applied for and hoped to get a grant to buy some new library furniture. Library furniture is very expensive, as probably most of us know, and did not end up getting that grant. So we kind of had to do it on the cheap and use some furniture we already had in the library. So that was fine. And then we did have a smaller amount of money that we could use to buy things like a child-sized table, toys, we got a glider rocker, kids' books, really fun things like that. And I don't know if there's a place you can link to, Michael, at all with like show notes or anything like that, but like it's a beautiful room. I'd love to share photos of it if that's it. There's photos of it in our book, by the book. There you go.
I want to point out there's also space for adults in there. You know what I mean?
Oh,
So
yes.
there's you can I met with a psychology graduate student recently and she brought her child. We met in that room. There was a computer. We had laptops, but there is a computer you could sign into and use as an adult studying, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a half and half space. Like half of it, there were two computers, some tables on wheels so you can kind of rearrange them, a whiteboard, so anything just that you might use for individual study or group study. And then the other half of the room was the kid area. So yeah, if you can go in there, close the door, then that helps with your kids, not escaping or if there is any noise there. But it also does provide that space either for individual study or group study. And kind of a secret other like underlying hope is that the kids would end up liking coming to the library with mom and dad, that they have good associations with a university library, that when they, I mean, it's not that many years until these kids grow up and are potentially going to college themselves. So maybe they have better associations with the academic library or like, oh yeah, I always went with my mom and that was so fun having some different toys in there. So just kind of having those, I don't know, good vibes in there as well.
And that is an important point because from a social mobility standpoint, it really can break the cycle of poverty to have one parent go to school and children experiencing their parents going to school is a predictor of the children also going to on to higher education. One thing I want to mention is we had a student comment in one of our surveys that our student employees who worked, you know, sometimes evenings and weekends with little supervision, we had an adult, you know, full-time staff working in the library, they couldn't oversee everything, would occasionally give the lactation room key to their friends who wanted to study. And this is an issue with this, you know, study room here too, where people want to use it because it's cheerful and fun and a space, you know, there's a premium on group study space. So trying to navigate that is, can be a challenge, but it's, you know, it's one tiny space on campus that's just for student parents, you know?
Yeah.
And I do want to say too, because Ellie's absolutely right in what she was saying, that doing something like this can have a multi-generational impact, because so much research shows that children's academic achievement most closely mirrors that of particularly their mothers. And we also know that women make up about 71% of all student parents. And so it's especially important, I think, to support those student parents, and that they see their parents going to school. They are more likely to go to school themselves. And again, even if you're kind of having to sell this to a university in terms of money or business impact, whatever it is, it's creating future students. Yeah. It's ensuring your university is going to keep going, right? Like, you're going to have more students who enroll down the line. Because again, like I said, it's not that long before these kids grow up and are going to be going to school themselves. And so it really, these small changes or things we can do to support these students can have this really big multi-generational impact.
Now, I have to say, as I was reading that chapter and I was thinking about my own institutions, we used to provide coloring books and crayons to student parents so that their children could be occupied. Those were typically donated by librarians or library staff members who had kids and wanted to contribute. Now, you at Boise State discussed the STEM backpack. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the STEM backpack, how that came about, what's included in it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'd love to. This is another kind of example of me trying to find a way in and being stubborn in my wanting to have a family study room and not making that happen for several years. And I do think it's actually really important to address, like I said a couple of minutes ago, if you can't have a dedicated study space, maybe can you just have one little corner of the library that has the kids' table, the kids' rug, a couple of toys? Doesn't have to be a big dedicated study room. You saying that, like, putting out coloring books and crayons, great. That is such a small, big thing. Like, it's such an easy thing to do. But it's such a big impact because it's an indicator to these student parents, like, aha, crayons, I can bring my kid in. They're giving me a coloring book and crayons, so you're not going to yell at me for bringing my child in. Those are really, really important signs to student parents that they are going to be welcome there. So kind of one of the mid-level things, I guess, that I was trying to do before we had the family study room set up with these backpacks, these kits. So I was able to get a fairly small grant, but from the Idaho STEM Action Center. And so they needed to be a STEM themed backpack. So I bought 10 backpacks and I came up with 10 different themes, and I wanted them to be for different ages. So I had from 0 to about age 12, I'd say. So I picked out different toys and different books to go in each backpack. They're bright, colorful backpacks. And then we put the checkout thingy, barcode thingy, on the backpack, not like the individual things in the backpack. And again, it's that visual signal of, okay, there's something they're providing for my kid. I'm allowed to bring my kid in there. And then it has something to entertain the child. That was a really important lesson that I learned from the backpacks, was to provide quiet noise for the backpacks. And some of the toys we ended up taking out and only using for certain family-centered events because they were very loud. But the baby one had, you know, stacking cups, little squishy blocks, a couple of board books in it. The most popular one was our Legos one, just had a big old sack of Legos in it, and they could play with it. We figured some of them would get lost, and they probably did. Nobody was sitting and counting all the Legos, but that's okay. And so different things like that. And I believe that's also included in the book, that one of the appendices, that all the things that we had in the different backpacks. I think if you wanted to do this, if I were to do it again, I think we probably could have gotten away with maybe even just three or four backpacks, because we saw which ones were most popular. And just having a couple of them to check out, it signals to the students that they're welcome. It gives their kids something to do. They could just sit next to each other, one of your regular study tables. You don't need a special space for them. You don't need a dedicated space for them. If you can't provide that right now, anything you can do to provide that kind of support, I think, can make a really big difference. And that's why I tried to kind of lay out some of the different levels of things, or kind of, you know, how much money do you have? All right, here's what we can do with that, is because I know we can't all take these big swings, but I do think all of us can take these small steps.
And because money is so tight in most academic libraries, or at least at Boise State, you know, I want to point or highlight that Kelsey got the funding for this through the Idaho STEM Action Center. She wrote a small grant, not super small, but, you know, these are these local ways of getting funding to support these projects. So just because you can't get the money from your library dean doesn't mean, you know, Kelsey was creative and she found ways to make things happen.
So as we think about this, what's that one piece that each academic library can do to get started to support student parents? What would you think is that one action?
I think even something like the coloring books and crayons, I think something small like that. And then the other thing is to get this conversation going. I want to say a policy. I don't think that's necessarily where to start. I would just kind of jump in by being like, okay, we're going to say student parents are welcome. If we need to hammer out some language on policy later, we can do that. But I think sometimes we can kind of get hung up on the official policy and the wordsmithing and all of that. But just having a step like that, and one of our, we call them case study, what did we call them? Field notes, Ellie? Field notes.
Yes,
that we
field
have
notes, yeah.
Yeah, in the book, talks about a similar thing to what you said, kind of this low level, just putting out a few coloring books, a few crayons, things like that, to indicate to students that they can come in. And then it kind of cracks open that door so you can have those bigger conversations. And then if you start to get some student parents coming in, you get these students coming in with their children, you see them and maybe you can kind of start to roll the ball along a little bit further and put together a couple of kits, have one little area of the library be a space where you can bring your kids. I think it opens the door for those conversations.
And I would say, along with those things, you know, having a policy or at least some language saying that children are allowed in the library, available in a clear place on the library website, and simply making, you know, our library at some point decided these floors are collaborative floors. You could be noisy, and these other floors are quiet floors. And we got some signage out that made it very clear. We got some wall vinyl, you know, so it's large. Mm-hmm. And so as you get to each level of the library, you can see that. And I think that can alleviate a lot of anxiety, even without mentioning children. It's like, okay, this is a noisy space. It's cool. And then, you know, as public service people, librarians and staff, notice and develop relationships. You know, some recent research has shown that for all college students, having a meaningful relationship with one person that works for the university, whether it's an instructor or someone else, can make the difference between, you know, getting through college and not. And that's especially true for students that are struggling with, you know, extra issues, such as, you know, not having adequate childcare, being overly busy. There was a time study that was done where like it's actually impossible to be a parenting student, but you know, but so I highlighted that one in one of the chapters.
So as we wrap up our time together, I was wondering what you're working on now. Are you continuing to explore how libraries can support student parents? Or are you heading in new directions with your research?
We've talked about different ways to move forward with this. I think one of the things that we would love to be able to do is get a grant to see if there are some small interventions we could do with student parents, additional ones to see what would help. And we, you know, bandied about different ideas like a parking pass, giving the students a parking pass. Would that, how much of an impact would that have? What about if we did this? Just kind of these different small interventions to see what would really be impactful. Emergency funds, emergency gas gift cards or food gift cards, things like that. What would be really what is needed? And I think, no, sorry, I will stop with that. Ellie, did you?
So in terms of student parents, I really want to make sure the space is really at a premium and people always want a piece of library space. So I really want to get the word out about the student, the parenting, the family study room, and find ways to make sure it gets used. So I'll be working with Kelsey, and we have a new librarian who's really interested in that here also. So that's not really research, but it's outreach. My own research, you know, I'm excited to work with Kelsey if we do find some funds to do these interventions, but I'm actually kind of in a different direction for the main part of my work and looking at research data management policies and how, you know, universities and university libraries can support good data management. So it's support of open science. So it's kind of different, but it's this data analysis piece and making sure that we're having an impact on society that's the same.
Excellent. Well,
okay? Yeah. You're like trying to wrap us up and you've gotten us going. So I think too that there is a place for, there's so many different areas to go with this research. I would love to see somebody write something similar, but focusing on community colleges. I think that this book could be rewritten or revamped in 5 years. I think we're actually at a moment where there's more and more attention on student parents. And we found there's a chapter in the book where I kind of talk about some of the different efforts going on at different places in the nation. I think that there's a lot of these individual efforts going on, and I hope that we're moving toward kind of a bigger, more united attention on this topic, because I think there's these little pockets all over of people trying really hard to do things. We are part of that, but I think a larger conversation is starting. And I think that'll be a really important thing to pay attention in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years. I really think that this is going to be something that all institutes of higher education need to grapple with.
You know, if we don't meet our students where they are, we're not going to exist anymore. It's going to be Google University. So this is important for more reasons than just it's the right thing to do.
Well, that's actually a really great point. Well, Kelsey and Ellie, I really want to thank you for your time today. I really did enjoy this conversation. I'm your host, Michael Lamagna, and thank you for listening to the New Books in Library Science podcast channel on the New Books Network.